Accession number 10403, rule 4.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 4. Could you tell me a little more detail about how you organised the mobilisation of the National Defence Companies and the ATS?
We got a hold of the commander of the National Defence Company, and we had a church hall which was earmarked for the reception. We brought them in, gave them the drill hall, and then organised by our transport the collection of accommodation stores from Catterick. So we then got the accommodation stores, all the buckets and latrine buckets and all the sorts of stuff organised and brought it up into the hall for them. And then did whatever we could to help them. We lent them two or three men to get something done. And then once they were formed, we just withdrew.
What about the ATS?
The ATS was a different problem. There were women who had never been away from home before. They all came into the drill hall and reported. And we handed over the drill hall to them to remain one night until we could find out about their accommodation stores and where they were going. And we found that they had to go to Brownsworth Castle. And all the accommodation stores were sent there. And we took them by bus. We got a bus and took them there. And in about 4 or 5 hours, we had an SOS. And I sent the whole MT section down there to see what was the matter. And these girls had never been in a camp before. The tents had arrived, and the latrine buckets and all the pots and pails and everything that you need were all in a heap in the field. And these girls had never put up a tent in their lives. They'd done nothing. So what we had to do was to send the MT section and several of the men we could to go down there, erect a camp, and send most of the girls home. Of course, there was nothing to be done until that was done.
Now, what dates were these two organisations mobilised?
Well, that was before the mobilisation date of the TA. It was within the period from August to September.
And they'd been mobilised as administrative?
Yes, administrative, except the National Defence Company, which was supposed to look after key points. But they were administrative units.
How about the actual mobilisation of the 9th? How did that go?
Mobilisation of the 9th was fantastic. We were sitting there waiting for a telegram, which I think was Operation Comrel, I think they called it. And we were sitting waiting, virtually doing nothing by that time. And suddenly the Taliban came, Crumbel, and we had all the mobilisation papers and everything written out. We had everything written out. That's what we'd done. And we got all the dispatch riders, we got everybody else, and we sent them off to the company drill halls. And then the company drill halls went round and delivered the mobilisation papers to everybody at their doors. And this was in the morning, and by the evening, all drill halls were overflowing with people. We didn't know what to do with them. They all came in.
That was the 1st of September.
Yes, that was the mobilisation.
How about the equipment for everybody? That matched it?
Well, you see, in those days, everybody at home carried their uniforms, and they had their own underclothing, and they had their boots. They had everything at home, with the exception of their weapons. So they came in with a small kit and with everything else and based themselves on a drill hall.
What about the field kit, though? The large kit, you know, the things that... What about that? When did they get that?
You mean the tents and things? Well, we didn't have any at all because we were based in our drill halls. And all the officers came in, immediately took over their little commands. And we then started the position of feeding them. And we overcame that. It was overcame that by giving them ration allowance money. And they were fed at home. You see, they all lived, but it wasn't very far. They were fed at home, you see. And for a few days, that's how we did it, until we got ourselves organised as a complete unit.
What was the was the next stage of organisation, would you say?
Well, the next stage of organisation, whilst all this was going on, the men, of course, were just being pulled together, put into various formations, rifle drill, various other things to get themselves more familiar with the procedure. Then, of course, we had the medical examinations, we had the inoculations, and by the time that was finished, we were sent off to our concentration area, which was down in the Cotswolds, Chipping Norton.
And that was early October 1939?
Yes, that was early October.
By then you'd received all the equipment you needed for war, had you?
No.
No. So they just got what they stood up in and their small kit, and...
And what you might call the hand weapons, which we had in our own armories.
So the next stage, you went down to Chipping Norton.
Yes.
Area, and what were you in, camp or billets or what?
They were in billets. They were in barns. Anything they could find in the countryside, disused buildings, anything to get them in. And then the equipment, the re-equipment proper, of vehicles and everything else for the whole brigade. Was organized by division, because division had to form. 50 Div headquarters had to form at Burford, and they had to mobilize and form, and then they had to arrange for all the equipment to come, and it was broken down into various dumps, and we sent columns of vehicles. First of all, we went to Chirwell and got all our vehicles, because that was essential to be mobile, got all our vehicles and motorcycles, and from then we went and collected from the various depots all what we called our G1198 equipment.
And what's that?
Well, you see, there were two stages. In peacetime, you had an inventory, put it that way, a battalion inventory, of all the things that you need for peacetime training, and that is called the G1098. Now, the war equivalent of that, that is all your ammunition and all the weapons and like that, is on what they call an 1198. So we had to collect the difference between the 1098 and the 1198. And we collected that down in that area. Everything from hurricane lamps to wicks.
Was there any problem with the equipment? Was it an efficient procedure?
The procedure was efficiently conceived. In practice, there were problems due to distribution, due to the fact that the personnel handling them themselves had been mobilized and weren't quite familiar with the procedure. When you got your guns and your weapons, your props got the sights from one depot and the body of the gun from another and the firing pin from another. So they all had to be married up and taken to bits and cleaned and put together. So it wasn't inefficient of an administrative problem, which will happen in anything.
Did you have any problems with being given inadequate equipment or old equipment?
No, our equipment came absolutely first class. We might have complained about it in action, but that was just because the design was probably not what we wanted. But we have no complaints against the distribution and the man not receiving the correct amount of equipment he should have. He had the lot from socks to boots.
But earlier when we talked, you mentioned that there were, the only mobilisation probably you were really aware of was in the personal field, pay and things like that. Could you tell me about that on tape a little? What was the problem there?
Well, this was where the pay corps themselves were territorials. They weren't, as they are today, got computerized. They were all manual. And they themselves had to mobilize with a token force. So that when we issued pay books, and we issued from the battalion, we had to work on the man's pay book and our own copy of the pay and mess rolls and our own copy of Part 2 orders. We had not got confirmatory evidence from the pay office that what we were doing was right, or so on and so forth. We worked on the imprest account system, where we drew the money and paid. and the Pekor were therefore out of step with their records, because they themselves had to mobilize, get into offices or something somewhere and get their system going. And that caused, I suppose it caused hardship, although I wasn't aware of it, but it bound to cause some hardship in the fact that if a man made an allotment for his wife and she was paid through the post office, the instructions didn't get from the pay office to the post office, you see. That was the sort of problem that existed.
So that was the mobilisation. How about training? You had a period of training when you got to the Cotswolds.
When we got to the Cotswolds, we really went into war training.
What was the difference between war training and peace training?
Well, there were no restrictions. This was war training. We set up a 50th Divisional Battle School. That was where people could, units could go and go through the war drill and everything else in a designated area where there were no restrictions with farmers and private people, things like that. They could use their weapons and they could fire their weapons. The whole of your drill could be put into operation to a point, because at that time we were still under home service conditions. And home service conditions stipulated very rigorous safety precautions. And if an accident did happen, the procedures were pretty cumbersome. So that was the difference between a peacetime training and what I call war training, the pre-battle training, because it changed again after you had a battle.
So there was more freedom to buy weapons, but still stringent safety precautions.
Still stringent safety precautions. And, of course, I don't think at that stage we had then, that we hadn't, got ourselves to a stage of self-sufficiency in the field. You see, you were out for the first time, you don't go home. You were just in the field and you don't go home. And you must have self-sufficiency. And this comes back to Boy Scouting. And, of course, when we went to France, we were able to do another stage of training, different again.
Now, you were training as a motorised unit. Did
motorised
that mean that
everybody
unit. Everybody could be carried?
Everybody was carried. You had, every platoon had a 1,500-weight truck, which carried all the equipment. Didn't carry men, carried all the equipment, all the war equipment, the back of the lot. The men marched. But you had what they called troop-carrying companies, which were lorried troop-carrying companies, which were sent to you, troop-carrying companies, and the men were carried in lorries. That was the motorised unit.
So some of the companies were fully motorised and some were half motorised, would that be right?
No, they were all fully motorised.
But they marched, I mean...
Well, the point was if the troop-carrying lorries weren't available, you had to march. You see, once you go into a battle, you can't take troops right up into a battle in lorries. So therefore, they must be proficient in marching. So you lorry them as far as you can.
What about the carriers? What was their role?
Well, the carriers, we had a platoon of carriers, and they were a Bren gun. And they used those for reconnaissance. But in practical terms, and actually in the field in war, we found the great value of the carrier was its ability to cross country and take supplies to isolated units. We could get their rations and things up to them in a certain degree of protection.
Now, you were battalion transport officer still, were you, at this time?
At that time, but yes, at that time.
You were about to change, being brigade transport.
Yes, I was transport, yeah.
You get all this, as you increased your number of drivers and the number of trucks.
Yes.
Was there any problem with that? Did you have any trouble sorting it all out and getting everybody accustomed and shaking down into a proper fully motorised unit?
Not really. It wasn't in the training. The mechanical side of it wasn't so much a problem as the tactical side of it. And the tactical side of it was to train the drivers to appreciate what was going on when he was in the vehicle in hostile territory. And you see, you drove at so many vehicles to the mile, so many miles in the hour. As soon as you stopped, everybody leapt up and took up defensive positions around the truck. You didn't bunch. You had to go under trees. You had to camouflage. All this business, you see, was the training.
How long were you training there for then?
Well, early October
and January.
January we were off.
When did you actually become brigade transport officer? That happened while you were in England, didn't it?
Oh yes. What happens then was when the re-equipment of the brigade came about, with all this stuff going on, Jackie Churchill came and nobbled me and took me up to brigade to sort out the equipment of the brigade. You see, with all this. All business and getting all the stuff ready. And
why do you think he picked you?
I have no idea. I don't know. It's one of those things. But I got to like Jackie Churchill, and we were great friends.
What were your first impressions of him? He had commanded a battalion, one of the regular battalions.
Oh, he was a regular soldier. He was a martinet, if you put it that way. But I got to know him so well that... I rather regarded him as virtually as a father, because I would go to him with problems, and he would come and say, well, could you see this, or could you do that? If I would go to him and say, well, sir, why is that? He would go to extensive care to explain. And the thing that endeared him to me was that everything he did, he used to say, think, what is the reaction of the private soldier when this order has been issued from brigade? How long will it take to get to him? What will it be like when he gets to him? What will his conditions be like, and can he carry it out?
What was the structure at brigade then?
The structure at brigade was, we had brigade major, we had a staff captain, we had an IO, an intelligence officer, and a transport officer, full stop.
So not a large staff?
No, not a large staff. We had attached officers which came from the gunners to give advice on gunnery. We had one from the RSC on rations who would do that. We had somebody, a signal officer from division, but they were not part of brigade headquarters.
And what was your duty within it? You were a brigade transport officer. What did that entail?
Well, I had to do for the brigade what I'd done with the battalion. I had to maintain the whole thing efficiently. I had to see the whole brigade was properly trained in its various things mechanically, see the supplies and everything got there, and take my turn with the rest of the brigade staff in their various duties. You see, there was only a few of us, and we were on a roaster.
The bit about the transport thing. Were you now at once removed? Were you now supervising the work of the battalion transport officers?
Yes.
Or would you be interfering? Something interfering is a little harsh word, but what was the delineation between your responsibilities between brigade transport officer and battalion, and how did you work with them?
Well, I had to. Why virtually shall we say that the. I had to make certain that the battalion transport officers worked within the framework of instructions of brigade and worked as one unit and worked properly.
So you were checking and supervising their
yes,
work?
Yes.
And also presumably preparing or adapting the brigade transport plan. Would that be right?
That would be it. And what you had to do was you had to, when the orders were issued from brigade, or when we were all in this group together, you then had to give out your own sort of little plan. How are you going to handle them? If you went up into action, you see, when they went up into action, except for the A echelon vehicles, which were the fighting vehicles, all the transport had to be taken away. Once it was taken away, it had to be brigaded and lagered up in B echelon, and all that controlling, you see, was done. And it had to be got back at the right time. There was you split your unit in two into your fighting section and your other section, you see.
And you had to make sure
that I'd make certain that that side worked.
You knew where, so that would be planning where they were to go, would it be? And I mean the B echelon, where the B echelon lager was to be. Would you work out where that was?
Oh yes, we'd all be sitting there. We'd have the staff cap there. We'd have the map, and we'd say, right now, then the G people, they would tell you where they were going to put their dispositions of troops, and you'd have to work out your supply points. Get them all properly marked, get everybody advised where they are, make certain that the transport has put this, that and the other. In fact, it's the machinery of keeping it going.
So, having decided that the supply points were there and there, and the lagers were there and there, who would tell the relevant people? Would you tell the battalion transport officers, or would you tell the battalion...
Oh, you put it through the brigade net, and it would go straight down to battalion.
What's the brigade net?
Well, the brigade net would be that... you would have radio, or telephone, or Donar, in which all instructions, all informed, would go out. And your orders would be written. And you'd put on the orders, supply point map reference so-and-so, petrol point map reference so-and-so, collecting point so-and-so, map reference so-and-so. Now, that would be all the way go down and get to the brigade transport office, and you'd also say... B echelon will RV at so and so and give a map reference. And then you would make certain that at these various points, the representatives of the various people were actually physically on the ground with the stuff.
So So when it got to when you sent it out through the brigade net, not only could everybody see where these collection points were for their own use if they wanted something or.
Yes, they went and collected it.
Or if they wanted some supplies, but also would tell the battalion. The battalion transport officers and supply officers that is where they should put the stuff. So it would simultaneously inform both sides of what was.
Everybody's informed, all in one. That's a principle in the army. All informed.
And then having informed everybody through the brigade net, you would then.
You have to physically check.
Would you always physically check everything, or would you take just sample, or would you check the ones you knew were dodgy?
Or it's a question of priorities. If you weren't on duty. On the battle board, keeping the battle board up to date. If you weren't on duty there, then you'd go out and get on a motorbike, or you'd go somewhere, and you'd say, right now, I wonder if that. Let me see. You'd say, well, we've just done 200 miles march on motor vehicles. Petrol will be low. Oil will be low. They can do without their food for 24 hours, but they can't do without petrol. By God, I'm going to the petrol point and making sure that's working. You see. This was a sort of drill.
Now, just you mentioned it there. What motorbike did you have? You had your own motorbike issued, did you?
Well, I had. Yes, we had a pool of them. I had a pool of motorbikes, and I also had a truck.
Now, you mentioned the other duties, the roster, the brigade, side of your brigade duties.
Yes.
Which were part of just staff duties, I suppose.
Yes.
Could you tell me exactly what they were in theory? Not exactly getting onto the battle examples yet, because we haven't come to that.
No.
What was the theory of your other side?
Well, the theory of the brigade headquarters is, as I've told you, is all informed. And every movement of every unit and subunit is marked on what we call the battle board, which is a huge map of the area, and it's marked on with a chinagraph pencil, so it can be altered. And that is kept up to date by messages coming in, donars and everything. And whoever is on duty...
What are donars?
Dispatch riders. And everything that comes in from any source, is logged. Now, that battle board is the masterpiece. And if any visiting officer or any of your liaison officers come in to see you, whenever they leave, they must go to the battle board, get themselves up to date, take whatever notes, so when they go back to their own commanders, they can make certain his duplicate battle board is up to date. That's the battle board principle.
So each battalion CO had one of these as well?
Well, yes, he had a smaller one, but this principle was same. And the adjutant or the IO kept it for him.
Now, what was your part in this? You were just part of the team keeping
it? I was part of the team. For which we did that. You see, if the brigade major was on a recce with the brigade commander, then one of us would have to step up and do the job and handle the traffic, if you put it that way, until the situation reverted, or to be able to answer inquiries.
You could actually find yourself acting as brigade major then, if
oh yes, I mean, you wouldn't do anything daft, that he wouldn't do it. He would leave his instructions. But he's got to have a stand-in, and of course there's 24 hours a day, and you must sleep.
So, did you receive, you know, in this period in the Cotswolds, when you joined the brigade staff, Churchill's staff, did you receive any training in the principles of the battle board and the net, the brigade net, or were you already fairly well aware of it from your work in the battalion?
I was clued up pretty well. I'd been clued up. I mean, it was part of a general principle. I was clued up what was going on. I hadn't done it in great detail until I got the Cotswolds, but I was clued up.
Were there any other aspects of your work at brigade headquarters that you can think of? Not in action, because we're going to come to that. You had many responsibilities there, but I mean, was there anything else you were supposed to do in theory as a brigade transport officer?
I think that in theory, my job, apart from anything else, was to understudy all the other jobs in brigade headquarters. I think that was probably the, if I had any spare time, anything, I would understudy the job. I would understudy the job of whoever was at brigade headquarters.
Could you just summarise what those jobs were? You know, the people you mentioned. There's the brigade commander, obviously.
There's the brigade commander, and he has got his brigade major, who's responsible for translating all his instructions into written orders. There's the staff captain, who is responsible for seeing that all the administrative sides relating to those orders, how can be able to carry it out, are in fact dealt with. There is the motor transport officer, who apart from the transport is also responsible for seeing that the physical things that are required by those two individuals can be carried out. Then there's the intelligence officer, whose job is to keep the battle board up, and all the intelligence is in like that. And you have liaison officers from all units coming in all the day long. And you have, it's rather like a reception centre. You see, people will blow in and say, well, look here, have you heard what's happening on the left flank there? And if you happen to be there or on duty, you've got to do it. So that you can say the team, each has its responsibilities, but everybody understudies or should do what everybody else is doing. I mean, we find it in civil life.
Do you think it was a big enough team? It sounds a small team to me, you know, given that casualties could occur and various other things. Do you think the team was large enough for what it had to do, the responsibilities of running a brigade?
Well, strangely enough, you know, when you get to a headquarters, especially in situations that appertain, the less people you have, the better. Each one doing his function. And then after all, the training was such that periodically in quiet times, you called officers in from battalions, and you trained them in various little jobs, so that if you have casualties and things like that, you have got backup. And then you see, if officers who were trained like that and you were going into battle, you would have what you call LOB, left out of battle, and you would take those officers and put them in B echelon, so that you could come up. Just like in the battalion, they would bring in a second in command if the CO was killed. He wouldn't be in the battle, but he would come in.